Hello and welcome to the Third Sector podcast. I'm Emily Burt.
And I'm Lucinda Rouse. Each week we bring you half an hour of discussion and debate about the important goings-on in the charity world. This week we're marking International Women's Day by talking to the first female chief executive of one of the UK's biggest charities. We'll be questioning what's unique about the female-dominated nature of the charity sector workforce, both in terms of opportunities and challenges. And we'll question more broadly how tackling the enduring gender imbalance can lead to a more effective charity sector.
But before we get to that, we've got Andy Ricketts representing the Third Sector news team, and he's going to get us up to speed on a recent story. Andy, what's going on?
Well, there's big news about public services at the moment. It's quite the debate in the UK charity sector. You may know that 30% of the sector's income comes already from providing public services, and that's through contracts with local government, central government, and even things like the NHS, ranging from providing youth services to social care services, education and training, and even domestic violence and sexual abuse services. But the NCVO has been spearheading a campaign to try to get more funding for charities in this area, because you might remember that last November, before the autumn statement, which seems an absolute age away now, the NCVO organised a letter signed by more than 1,400 charities calling for the Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, to increase the amount of funding that charities get through their public service contracts. They basically wanted him to introduce rules that would make it mandatory for public bodies to uplift all existing and new grants and contracts. This was off the back of a survey that they did that found that 87% of charities providing public services were subsidising them themselves. So therefore, they weren't getting the full cost of providing those services. It was actually causing them a deficit to actually do these things. And charities have always had a kind of maybe difficult relationship with this whole subject, because they are being given money by the government to provide these services. It's the things they want to do. They want to be helping people in these different areas. But it creates a bit of a conundrum for them if it becomes more expensive for them to run that service than it should otherwise be. So the NCVO wrote to the Chancellor in November last year. Nothing happened in the autumn statement that resulted in an uplift of public service contracts, much to the disappointment of the NCVO and all those organisations that had signed that letter. But then last week, they finally got an answer from the Treasury to the letter they'd written in November. So the best part of 4 months later, Laura Chott, the Chief Secretary to the Treasury, responded to the letter, but in quite disappointing terms.
Well, I guess you probably wouldn't be expecting a positive response after waiting four months
for a reply.
No, and indeed, all that happened really was that she just mentioned the £100 million package that the government set out a year ago in the spring budget of 2023 to support the sector and other things like the Contract Readiness Fund, and didn't really commit to saying anything or doing anything new in this area. Sarah Vibert, who's the chief executive of the National Council for Voluntary Organisations, has said it's really disappointing that effectively it's taken this long for them to respond, and then they've just responded in a way that just sort of says, well, sorry, you're just going to have to get on with it. She said that while the sector was grateful for the measures that the Treasury put in place previously, it hasn't really responded to the crux of the issue, that public service grants and contracts are not properly funding to meet the rising cost of delivering them. And she said basically that the sector's gone unheard. And then subsequent to that, the NCVO has launched the full report into the research that they did around public service contracts. And it shows a really bleak picture in what's happening across the UK in terms of charities not only subsidising these contracts, but also even not getting uplifts for years and years and years. And obviously we've seen massive inflationary pressures in recent months and years, but even before that, the amounts that charities were getting wasn't going up. So it's a pretty grim picture. We're obviously recording before the spring budget takes place. But to be honest, I'm not sure if many people are really expecting much in the way of positive good news for charities delivering public services for the remainder of this week.
And did the NCVO go as far as outlining what the consequences of this continued failure to uplift the public service contracts could be for those services?
Yeah, I mean, the bare fact is that they say that many charities will either stop operating completely or stop delivering these services because they just become too expensive and then don't want to use their charitable funds in those particular way. I mean, they're saying that their reserves are already overstretched. We might see some charities taking the, in some cases, quite brave decision to step away from those contracts. We have seen some of that. We might see more of it. There is ultimately a fear that some charities might even go out of business if it becomes unsustainable for them to provide this service. And if it is one of the big things they do, for example, then that's a real concern. We are already seeing stories of charities across the UK sadly closing. I hope we don't see more because of the lack of uplift in these public service contracts.
Moving on to the main part of this week's discussion, how does the charity sector shape up in terms of gender equality? Not very well, according to a study released by Pro Bono Economics in November. It found that men hold most of the influential positions across leadership, trustee boards, and philanthropy. So let's start at the board level. The study found that men outnumber women 2-1 on charity boards in England and Wales, while just 29% of board chairs are women. And then in charity management, women form 68% of the voluntary sector's workforce, but just 1/3 of the top 100 charities by income are led by women. But for the whole sector, between 56 and 63% of all charity chief executives are women. So that is clearly more representative. Then thinking about donors, 7 women versus 69 men featured in the recent Sunday Times giving list. And let's not forget about the service users. Women are far more likely than men to experience poverty, ill health, and have caring responsibilities for parents, children, and partners.
So I think we can agree that it's a bit of a dicey picture there in terms of gender equality. And there are potential other consequences of this. We know, for example, that there is a certain neglect for gender-specific charities for women and girls. So, for example, the Rosa Foundation found that less than 2% of grants in 2021 went towards organisations that support women and girls. But having said that, the charity sector is generally a growing source of employment for women. In 2022, the sector was the source of 1 in every 25 jobs filled by women. Now, I'm not particularly sure about why this is, but it may have something to do with flexible working arrangements in the aftermath of the pandemic. We know that a lot of charities are experimenting with hybrid working today, and we know that flexible working is really important when it comes to accessibility of work for women and people with caring responsibilities. According to Sybil Harrison, who was interviewed by Zoe Amar for our Third Sector recently, she runs the marketing and digital recruitment agency Stopgap. Charity job candidates actually ask about hybrid working opportunities before salaries, with flexibility and positive culture seen as good trade-offs by candidates who might command higher salaries elsewhere. So that might also be a good point for kind of improving the gender equality picture across the charity sector. So, not necessarily many answers, but we do have a wonderful guest who is joining us today. Charmaine Griffiths is the Chief Executive of the British Heart Foundation. And we're delighted to have you with us in the studio to talk a little bit about your personal insights around what it's like to lead one of the UK's biggest charities as a woman today.
So, hi, Charmaine. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Great to be with you.
You have a very important job, and you have been working in the charity sector for about 2 decades now, if I'm not mistaken. And in the meantime, you've also been working in the science world, the latter of which is clearly a very male-dominated space. How have things changed from your perspective since you joined the British Heart Foundation for the first time in 2003 to where we are in the charity sector today?
My goodness, what a great and big question. So as the British Heart Foundation's first ever female chief executive, I feel but very privileged, it goes without saying, in my day job. The BHF is a bit of magic, attracts really smart people who are really driven to make a difference for people living with heart and circulatory disease. And that's always made it very special. And that's as true today as it was 20 years ago. I guess coming to the subject of International Women's Day and thinking about gender equality in particular, I think I've seen, and I'm proud to have seen, a lot of change, not just in the BHF, but across the sector overall. I think we've recognised collectively that to make the most difference in and make the most of a dent in the universe for the people we're here to serve, we've just got to be representative of the communities we do serve. And I'm very proud to be BHF's chief exec, to be its first female leader, and to know so many brilliant leaders of all kind of genders and backgrounds across the sector. Your stat, I think there is still work to do. We all recognise that. Lots of things have changed. Pandemic, people's preferences, people's need and desire for purpose and to contribute in life, as well as the economic and other factors. And I think we're finding our way through that at the moment.
And part of the remit and the mission of the British Heart Foundation is to address gender inequalities in science and in the healthcare world. I was wondering, to what extent do you see these inequalities translated into the charity sector as well?
You're right. So we published an Igniting Change strategy to tackle equality, diversity and inclusion and build on the progress we've made a year and a half ago. And we report every year in quantitative as well as qualitative sense on our progress. And we felt the need to do that for a number of reasons. One is heart and circulatory disease is a disease of inequality. It is always tracked against people who live in tougher circumstances and potentially have more diverse backgrounds. So we know that we've got a job to do in actually our mission. And the three kind of pillars of that strategy are: one, to be a team that is representative of the communities we serve and hold ourselves to the highest standards of inclusion as an organisation. And I'm pleased to see our metrics either moving in the right direction or already having achieved some of our goals, which is great. We recognise, as one of the UK's leading independent funders of cardiovascular research and one of the most influential too, we've got a duty in leadership to change the very nature of science and health as well. So our strategy for equality, diversity, inclusion has two really important pillars. One on making sure our resources are there for the people who need them most, and we're making the most impact we can in tackling health inequalities. And two, in terms of our funding power, we're using our actual funding of research to make a more diverse research and cardiovascular environment. I think it's really shocking to imagine that only 1 in 8 cardiologists in the UK today are female. And perhaps it's not a surprise then that there is a bias both in the nature of research to drive treatments and also in the diagnosis of women, that we're finding that there is lacking. We need to do better. We need to have more recognition that women are diagnosed early and treated appropriately for heart attacks, which at the moment isn't quite at the same level as men.
I think that something that you have hit on there, which I think can definitely be expanded out to the charity sector, is actually the importance of insights and the importance of data. So the fact that you were able to pinpoint there that you only 1 in 8 cardiologists are women in the UK. And we also have data around women in the charity sector. We were able to point earlier to the fact that even though, you know, 56 to 63% of all charity chief executives are women, only a third of the top 100 income generating UK charities are in that space. So we have this, but we also have very, very patchy data about broader diversity across the UK charity sector. It's very hard, for example, to look at, say, how many female chief executives of colour are currently working in the UK charity sector, how many people from the LGBTQ community, how many people with disabilities. And that data and that knowledge is power, isn't it? And that is how you start to move the dial, is by taking a really hard look at the facts. So there's definitely a need to be building that picture up, because unless you do that, there's no way you're going to be able to take an intersectional approach to improving gender equality and all other kinds of equality in this space. I'd love to hear a little bit more about your perspective on the unique makeup of the charity sector workforce and what you see as the big challenges and the opportunities that this presents.
There's no doubt in my mind, having been part of the sector for 20 years, about the real impact and precious value that the sector makes to society across the UK. I think it's phenomenal. There's something very special about it. It's such a vast number of people engaging in organisations that truly want to make a difference for other people. I think it's inspiring, inspires me every single day. And my pleasure, of course, to be part of the BHF team, but also to work with the Cranfield Trust as their chair and a few other organisations that are just phenomenal, truly inspiring. And there's no doubt, whether you think about it in terms of kind of financial impact and the scale of contribution the charity sector makes, or just the number of lives it touches for good every day, it's a very special thing. I'm personally convinced that in order to make the biggest impact for people, we have to be representative of the UK community as a sector, and that there are some brilliant, brilliant pockets of the organisations that work, of charities that already do that ably, but collectively we've got some way to go. You've already called out the leadership stats, which show that particularly given it's International Women's Day, there is gender inequality in leadership positions at board and executive team level. And it's worrying to think we're doing way better than some commercial entities. So the FTSE stats about female chief exec, for example, are even worse. So we should be, you know, taking comfort of the fact we are heading in the right direction, but I'd love to see that go faster. I think some of the challenges are that change takes time. It's about taking positive action, it's about cultural change in organisations, it's about people having networks of support as well as opportunity that allow them to take those steps. And it can be a deeply personal journey as well as one that's driven by data at a sector level. So, Jo, I'm an optimist in life and I believe that we will get to a better place and a more balanced place as a sector. And we're on that journey at the moment. But I am impatient for change. And I think initiatives like International Women's Day that shine a light on what is the state of play in terms of facts and data and what advice and practical support can we give each other to help move towards that more equal and diverse sector, I think is just great.
Absolutely. I thought that insight that you brought in the introduction from the recruitment consultant about how charity job candidates tend to ask about hybrid working opportunities before they ask about salaries was really interesting. And I wondered if there is a correlation between that and the fact that that is a priority and that well over 60%, 68%, whatever it was, of the charity sector workforce is made up of women. From your professional life working in the charity sector versus in more of the science world previously, do you see more accommodation for women with caring responsibilities, for example, within charities than within the scientific environment? Or is this too much of a black and white comparison that's not helpful?
I so wish I could tell you that it was different in other sectors. As you said, I had the pleasure of working in science and within health and the NHS and within academia and within the charity sector. And there's a lot of common ground. It's a huge challenge. My observation would be that more or less at the entry level, so as people start their careers, that I see a lot more equity between positions. And if you think about it from a gender point of view, it's as people come to that age when they're having children and then caring responsibilities for family kicks in that we start to see a real impact on people's career progressions. There is absolutely no doubt it's a common challenge across sectors. I'm absolutely passionate about making sure that we make a big difference for that. We know it's not just the practical impact of childcare and caring responsibilities. We know that there is, of course, a lot of bias in any system and in this system too. And so making sure that we are doing everything we can to level the playing field and, in fact, to give people equitable opportunities and to take proactive and positive action where's required to help us get to a better place is going to be needed. It won't course correct at the speed I'd love it to do without positive action. And I think that's why I'm really excited about the work we're doing at the BHF, and I'm passionate to work with other organisations that are doing that, because we need those leaders. We're missing out on brilliant talent that otherwise won't have the opportunity to shine and make that difference in the world. I think it's really challenging for people with caring responsibilities and childcare responsibilities and parent caring responsibilities or grandparent generally actually to balance life. And I hope that if there's a few good things we bottled from the pandemic, recognising we had ways to be more flexible and accommodating of what everybody needs to have a good life as well as contribute fully in their role is possible, and not only possible but enjoyable. And we can make changes practically that don't diminish productivity, that don't hinder us, that actually do the opposite. They allow us to bring the very brightest brains together across the country, wherever people might be in the UK, to help us solve problems and join teams. And at the BHF, we have a fantastic people team who've led the way for us in showing us how to set policies that are more inclusive, how to listen carefully to what really matters to people and what will help them make better choices for themselves, how to attract people who we want and desperately need to help in our mission work and become the best charity we can be. What do we offer that really counts? And so there have been some really brilliant things, whether it be parental leave policies or flexible working policies. We have a flexibly connected program that encourages us as a whole BHF to think about how to support people's personal lives and what they need from us as well as what we need from them. And I think that rounded view has helped us become a much stronger team and I hope a happier team as well as a BHF. It's certainly allowed us to make practical changes without detriment at all, in some cases, in a lot of cases, enhancement to who we are.
Do you have any other policies and programmes at British Heart Foundation which are designed around supporting women's professional progression, particularly into leadership positions of your organisation?
So we have a leadership programme that we are running at the moment for all of our senior leaders and some management programmes that encourage and enhance opportunities for people to get access to progression. And we are determined and committed to making sure they're available to everybody who wants the opportunity to progress so that we're equitable in that. So we don't have any specific women's initiatives, but we are trying to encourage all colleagues to think about their careers and their development needs. One of the things we have, which has been phenomenal within the BHF, it has changed who we are, is a series of affinity groups that are people brought together by common challenges or common life experiences. And we ask and are grateful for them to help share both their insights with us as a team, but also to give us advice and counsel on how best to make change as a team. And brilliant examples of those groups would be a parent affinity group, so working parents sharing with us some of the things they think we could and should do better, which has been great. And people who come together around, for example, caring responsibilities. And I'm really proud that in April this year, we'll be launching just the latest in a series of policies. And this one will be holistic support leave, so giving people much more option in terms of taking leave where they need it to support, whether it be caring duties or recuperation from procedures. So just us thinking way more flexibly about what people need and how we can support that. And I think you mentioned that the majority of the workforce across the charity sector is women. It's been roughly in the mid-60s% for probably a decade or so. And there may be upticks post-pandemic with a desire to be more flexible in our working patterns. And I don't really know why that is. I think that it's an interesting question, is that I'm not quite sure why it's predominantly a little more female than male. But I think absolutely making sure that everybody who joins the sector to make a difference in the world has equitable opportunities to do what they want, whether that be a flexible working pattern in life or they're interested in taking my job at some point and we give them the opportunities to develop into that. It's only, I think, by listening to what matters to people that you can truly carve out paths that allow people to get what they want in life too.
Mm. And being, I think, transparent as well about your own work is also really important. So I think it's brilliant that the BHF publishes its gender pay gap. And I know that you had a really, really good year for your gender pay gap last year in terms of your reporting. You saw your gender pay gap close significantly. But also to come back to that intersectional piece, that the BHF also publishes its ethnicity pay gap. So it's very interesting that you are deciding to put those numbers out there so that you can actually benchmark every year the progress you're making and get some of those vital numbers behind it.
It's so important to us. I mean, we're a science and data-led organisation, and so it's really important to us to use that on the basis of assessing true progress for us and to be proud about the progress we're making. And there are lots of areas where we're already doing brilliantly. We don't have a significant gender pay gap, for example, would be one example. And we're proud to see that we're establishing some of the policies that we believe are world-class, let alone sector-class, and helping our colleagues have fuller and better lives. I think it's also important to share where it's difficult, and that's where the data really comes in. So where are the things that are tricky to change? Where are the things that are taking longer than we would want? And just remaining steadfast and committed to the actions around them. We're a positive sector generally, an optimist sector. Who wouldn't want that in a charity sector? I think being open about where we've struggled to make progress and using data to be really truthful about that is super important.
And going back to your recent drive to make the organisation a much more flexible one to work in. I'm presuming that a lot of that came out of the pandemic and the way that organisations across the board were forced to work in a different way and seeing that that was possible. But I was wondering if you had to make any sacrifices to bring about more flexibility for your workforce. Were these changes and these measures introduced at the expense of something else in terms of the way that the organisation was working well?
So our Flexibly Connected programme, which is what we call the home, I guess, for all the choices and activities and decisions around flexibly working, was led by two of my brilliant colleagues and the exec team and a team of people from across the organisation, from a real mix of job types and locations. And they've really helped us charter the path through this. I think you're right, there are of course trade-offs. I can't think of the last time, certainly in my life, that I think the whole world, let alone our sector, went through such a seismic shift. Of course, we're still reeling and living every day with the consequences of that, particularly the burden that the people here to serve feel. And I guess the reason I mention that is because everybody had their own very personal and unique experience in personal lives as well as professional lives. And I think, I don't know of anyone who's not had a reset or an adjustment in how they do things as a consequence. And I think one of the challenges for us was working out what the BHF way needed to be when you had thousands of very personal experiences and very personal preferences. And for us, trying to be as accommodating for what mattered to people individually, as well as creating some consistency in the BHF, was probably one of the hardest things for us to get right. And we're still experimenting, even today. So every new policy we'll learn from, every time we offer changes or find a new way to do things, we're constantly experimenting and learning with it. And you've talked about data and listening before, but for me and the team, holding on to objective data about what that looks like and listening to colleagues has been the most important thing to get right.
Thank you so much, Charmaine. So just to wrap up then, you've given us so much food for thought over the past 20 minutes. But to finish, I wonder if you have any quick fire tips that you could share for leaders of other charities, whether they are big or small, who are maybe looking to level that professional playing field to make sure that they are creating a culture which is as equitable as it can possibly be. What advice would you give them?
I'd start with recognising that to make the most difference in the world, you've got to be representative of the communities you serve. Otherwise, the insights, the empathy, the connections that help you have impact and change the world are less. So recognise you need to be representative of the communities you need to serve, which so many brilliant charities and organisations across the UK already are. And then I think in terms of giving us all the best chance of doing that as well as we can, making the most impact, I think it's about listening, understanding what matters to people, giving people opportunities to create new things, to experiment, to do new, try out new ideas and concepts, to innovate, but also supporting people in their development. Generally, our team know what we need to do better than anybody in the world. So it's about listening to what people need, making sure we've got the right support and infrastructure in place as an organisation, and just being, I think, quite determined to stick with it. We all know big cultural change takes time. There are very few shortcuts, very few quick fixes. And so it's about playing our part as a BHF. Also recognising this is a big societal change and it's going to take a lot of effort from countless people over a long haul. So not getting, I think, also disillusioned with that, holding on to the fact it is not only the right thing to do, but it will make us even better in our mission, I think is probably the best piece of advice I've been given as well, is just recognising it will take time to achieve real change, as all real change does, but don't lose any kind of hope and just stay absolutely determined to make that difference.
Charmaine Griffiths, thank you so much for joining us.
A pleasure. Lovely to speak with you both.
We hope you enjoyed our discussion with Charmaine. And if you'd like to hear more from her, well, you're in luck, because she appeared last year on another podcast produced by Third Sector's parent company, Haymarket.
What's it like to lead a failing business? What do underwear-thieving gnomes have to do with CEO pay? And what on earth is resenteeism? I'm Ailish Cronin, and I'm the co-host of Management Today's Leadership Lessons podcast. In weekly episodes, we delve into the world of leadership through interviews with high-profile CEOs, academics, and authors, as well as analysis of the news, trends, and ideas you need to know about. You can find us all on the usual podcast platforms.
That's it for this week. Next week, we'll be joined by the digital specialist Zoe Amar to fill us in on the latest developments in the world of artificial intelligence and how these affect charities.
And before we go, it's awards season. And if you are a charity with a great campaigning story to tell this year, you do still have time to enter the 2024 Purpose Awards. These celebrate campaigns that use creative ideas successfully to further positive causes. And they also acknowledge the organisations behind them. They're open to agencies, brands, public sector bodies, charities, and NGOs through the EMEA. And the deadline for entering the Purpose Awards has now been extended to Thursday, the 14th of March, so you still have time to get that entry in.
But from us for now, thanks to our guest Charmaine Griffiths and our producer Nav Pal.